You're listening to the Garrett Ashley Mullet Show on Anchor FM. I'm Garrett Ashley Mullet, and I want to talk about everything.
Tell me, Mr. Anderson, what good is a phone call if you're unable to speak?
Welcome back to the Garrett Ashley Mullet Show. This is, of course, Garrett Ashley Mullet coming to you from Greeley, Colorado for episode 551 of this podcast. Today is Friday, February 3rd, 2023, and that was a small clip. You probably recognize it from The Matrix. And it's the scene, as you know, I'm sure, where Neo is taken in for a little bit of questioning by the agents because he has been found to be an associate or somehow acquainted with this terrorist, Morpheus. Now, is Morpheus actually a terrorist or are the agents terrorists? That scene right there goes a long way to showing you, who is the good guy, who are the bad guys. The agents are actually the bad guys. But that clip comes to mind because in this episode, I want to talk about Technopoly by Neil Postman. And what is a Technopoly? We'll get into that here in a little bit. Also, a very uncanny commercial advertisement that Pfizer put out with the help of Martha Stewart. We'll touch on that one. And some goings on with China. China is apparently investigating a spy balloon that was spotted over Billings, Montana, where I've been lots and lots of times. I've been there many, many times. I'm from Montana originally. But we're going to talk a little bit about that, as well as China moving in or trying to move in to the neighborhood near a Air Force base in North Dakota. But before we get into all of that, I want to talk just a little bit, just briefly, about something I stumbled across on Reddit. So I follow a Reddit called Jordan Peterson. That's the name of it. And as you might imagine, it is something of a gathering place for people who really love and appreciate Jordan Peterson, fans and aficionados and devotees, if you will, as well as critics of Jordan Peterson. So both alike can be found at the Reddit for Jordan Peterson. As such, I think that this post is mocking, criticizing, condemning Jordan. I could be wrong, but the quote from Jordan Peterson is, "It was always about freedom of speech." That's a direct quote. "It was always about freedom of speech." What does that have to do with Jordan Peterson? Well, if you didn't know, Peterson came to our collective attention initially because he refused to abide by some speech codes in Canada with regards to preferred pronouns. He was being told, everybody was being told up in Canada, that in the interest of respecting human rights, if someone tells you that their pronouns are A to Z, you have to use those pronouns when you're referring to them or talking to them. You have to use those pronouns. And if you don't, then you are violating that person's human rights. You are discriminating. You are a bigot. You are guilty of hatred and discrimination and violence, really. You are doing violence against that person. And the way that this works, right, just to explain briefly, for those of you who've always been confused by how someone would arrive at that conclusion or that kind of an assessment, The logic can be traced back at least to Dr. Spock and his notion that self-esteem is the most important thing that you could inculcate or instill in children. And so spanking is wrong. Telling children no is wrong. If you spank them, if you tell them no, if you correct them, if you discipline them, you are going to damage their self-esteem. Yes, you might get them to change their behavior, but you'll damage their self-esteem, which means that you will damage their confidence in themselves, which means that they will be handicapped, on into their adult lives. You will have harmed them. You will have abused them. You will have done them a deep emotional and psychological wrong and injury. So you don't want to do that, right? A whole generation or two or three now have been raised far too much in light of or in the darkness of Dr. Spock's prescription for what parents should think of when it comes to correction or the lack thereof or discipline or the lack thereof or spanking, corporal punishment for children as a corrective or the lack thereof. Well, what else is going to happen when you have a generation or two or three in Canada and in the U.S. and in the West generally influenced by these kinds of ideas, even if they don't come directly from Dr. Spock all the time? He was communicating something that was just kind of in the water at that point in time, a natural progression of a certain secular way of thinking and a certain deference to the experts, a certain scientistic way of figuring out what the right thing to do is, even when it comes to parenting. Parents are not competent to train their children, raise their children. They need experts to tell them how to do it, and so on and so forth, in every area of life. But in this particular area of life, a generation or two or three being raised with the parenting philosophy that you don't want to correct your child, you don't want to tell them no, you don't want to discipline them because it might harm their self-esteem, has produced a generation or two or three of adults who, to a disturbing extent, think that and are convinced, they're fully persuaded that for someone to tell them, no, you're wrong, is violence. And it's not violence in the physical sense necessarily, although you wouldn't know that just listening to how turbulent their emotional response can be. Many on the left, many who are woke or social justice warriors, you wouldn't know it from hearing their reactions that it's not physical violence. But then they will say it will lead to physical violence. Either you start out telling me no, and then I do it anyways, and then you're like, no, I mean it. You either stop or I'm going to make you stop. Or they'll say, and if they can point to any examples whatsoever, they'll say, well, this is pretty much what everybody who is discriminating or disagreeing or critiquing or condemning, judging our life choices is possibly going to do. If they can find a example, a story, or even just say that there are stories of homosexual people being beaten or murdered because they're homosexuals, or transgendered people being beaten or murdered because they are transgendered persons, even if it's just murdered while also being gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender or queer. It's almost like dying with COVID versus dying due to COVID. If somebody who is transgender, bisexual, homosexual, lesbian, gay, is murdered, and there's even the faintest of suspicions that they were murdered because of their sexual identity, their gender identity, then it is said that we therefore have to silence people who would disagree with these ways of living or these ways of expressing oneself. But Peterson, he made the headlines and got into hot water, but then stuck to his guns because he said, no, I'm not going to use your preferred pronouns. It's one thing for you to say you want to be referred to as a she, even though you're very clearly a biological male. It's another thing for you to demand or to threaten my livelihood or my reputation or my life, even at a certain point, it works the other direction as well. It's another thing for you to threaten me if I don't use your preferred pronouns. It's one thing for you to say you want to be called such and such. It's another thing for you to try to bully me into using your preferred pronouns. And here's what's happened in the aftermath of that back and forth. Jordan Peterson has become phenomenally successful and influential. He is much sought after, not just because he knows things, not just because he has wisdom after a fashion, but because he has the courage to stand up to the wicked people who are trying to get us to all get on board with perversion. And they're trying to coerce and constrain our speech. If you can control people's speech, then you can, by extension, control their ability to mobilize any sort of opposition politically, socially, professionally to your plans and purposes. And then it becomes a gotcha game. It becomes very easy to get and hold on to power as long as you're playing by these new rules. And if you're the one who gets to constantly rewrite the rules at any time in the name of so-called progress, well, then you can always rewrite the rules so as to favor the outcomes that are going to be profitable to you from a monetary standpoint or from a political standpoint. So when Jordan Peterson said it was always about freedom of speech, and that gets quoted on the Reddit for Jordan Peterson with the image, which I'm going to read for you here, it's very interesting to unpack the ramifications. So what is the image that was shared along with this quote of Jordan Peterson? Well, it's just this. It's a tweet of Michael Knowles's with Trump, Make America Great Again 2024, imposed on a desaturated image of the White House with a whole lot of people gathered on the lawn. Michael Knowles writes, "Trump is calling to outlaw transgender ideology, not just for little kids, not just in classrooms or certain federal programs, at every level. This is an excellent development, and other potential 2024 candidates should follow suit." Jordan Peterson retweeted this and said, "I'd have to agree. I'd have to agree. Shots fired." If language is violence, if your speech is violence, to disagree with the left, to disagree with the woke, to disagree with the LGBTQ plus agenda movement, which is just, it's a hydra for the left. You know, check out The Madness of Crowds by Douglas Murray, who is openly a homosexual man, by the way. But he explains very clearly how, if you will, naturally, gay men and lesbian women and bisexuals and transgendered people typically want nothing to do with each other, and they get on each other's nerves in a fearsome way. The reason they're all lumped in together is because the left, and by this I mean the people who want communism here in the United States of America, or here in North America, or here in the West, or around the world, the folks who want communism really want to leverage that uncomfortability with transgenderism and homosexuality because it's unnatural, because it's evil. They want to leverage that to get themselves power and to keep power, to use that as a pretext for going after their political opponents or going after folks who are religious, because the folks who are religious have always been the main opposition to communism, since Karl Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto with Frederick Engels. Christians in particular have been the biggest opposition to communism. Rather, if you want to put it just the opposite way, where we recognize that Christianity is true and Marxism is actually the usurper, Marxism has, since Karl Marx co-wrote the Communist Manifesto, Marxism has been trying to eliminate Christian faith in the West and doing a disturbingly effective job of it in some ways, but also in other ways, it just can't. It can't do it. Even when communism takes over a country and laws are passed or edicts are handed down or penalties are doled out or examples are made of this or that Christian missionary or pastor or believer because their Christian faith is seen as a threat to communist rule being fully realized, it seems as though a very similar dynamic to the evil empire in Star Wars and the Rebel Alliance and the sentiment that Princess Leia communicates to Moff Tarkin and Darth Vader is actually descriptive of Christians in communist countries.
The more you tighten your grip, Tarkin, the more star systems will slip through your fingers.
But that is to say, right? That is to say that communism has not yet fully taken over here in the United States like it's trying to. It has not fully consumed the West like it's trying to. It's trying to tell us that it's won, just like the Bolsheviks did when they even named themselves in Russia. They called themselves the Bolsheviks because Bolshevik means the majority, and they were not in the majority. But it was a bluff. It was a confusion tactic because the idea wasn't to actually wait until they were the majority. The idea was to intimidate and cow and pacify the majority until they could prove in fact that these ideas are actually really good for you and we know what's best, right? To quote Ronald Reagan, the most terrifying words in the English language, the 9 most terrifying words are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. And if the leftists, the radical left here in the U.S. is thinking that they can bluff us all into acquiescing, they could be right. Or should I say, they could be right enough to actually get control, absolute control, outright control of the U.S. government and of North America and of the world. They could be right enough because I'm really sorry to say this, but the more I talk with friends and family from across the country, the more I hear again and again a pessimistic fatalism about the destiny of this country, the destiny of the republic. The more I talk with friends and family, the more I hear that there's just nothing that can be done for it. The left has the ball and they're going to win. And never mind that there is still time on the clock. And I've heard this more times than I could count. I don't find America in the book of Revelation. Now, is that a convincing argument? Let's just touch on that briefly. I don't find the United States of America in the book of Revelation. I've heard that, and every time I hear it, it's the same, just full stop right after those words are uttered, as if that proves it. That, there you go. There you go. What else could be possibly said? And here's what I would tell you. There's a lot of people and institutions and organizations that I don't find in the book of Revelation. Like, for instance, I don't find the Garrett Ashley Mullett household in the book of Revelation per se. I don't see it so called or so named explicitly. And so what? Does that mean that I stop working to try and provide for my family? Does that mean that I stop trying to fix the dryer when the dryer stops drying properly? Does that mean that I stop podcasting? Does that mean that I stop running to the grocery store when we're out of coffee creamer? No, of course. We don't think that way consistently because that's not actually the reason why we've checked out. The reason why we've checked out is not that I don't see the United States of America and the Book of Revelation. The reason why we've checked out is because we've been convinced, we've been persuaded that the cost relative to the benefit does not work out in favor of us intervening, rolling up our sleeves, getting engaged. We do not believe that the cost is worth the benefit. We don't believe that the risk is worth the reward. It's a prudential conclusion trying to find a principled excuse. And insofar as it's a prudential kind of an argument, we should consider whether the facts actually support the fatalism. I don't think that they do. I think that insofar as our minds are made up that we're not going to do anything, that we're not going to try, we're under a kind of magic spell, and the spell needs to be broken, and it could be broken if we were willing to peel back the layers of hypnosis that modern technology, big tech, corporate media, etc., have put us under as a people, as individuals, yes, because it's never been more easy to have very targeted manipulation of the individual based on our likes, based on our interests, based on our spending habits, based on our reading habits or lack thereof. It's never been easier to manipulate us at a very individual level to get us distracted or discouraged or all excited about something that we really ought not to be excited about. It's bait. If we could peel back those layers of manipulation and brainwashing and hypnosis, then maybe, just maybe, it wouldn't be a foregone conclusion. If we're not willing to peel back those layers, then sure, with that attitude, you're right. You're right. Nothing can be done about it, and it's a foregone conclusion that the left, and by the left, I mean the communists, a communist by any other name would still be a communist. Nevertheless, the communists who want radical redistribution of all wealth and power, of course, with them adjudicating what would be your fair share or my fair share of all of the above, the communists in the United States of America, they are playing to win. If we are opposed fundamentally to the idea of fighting them, if we're not willing to confront or contradict or debate them or call them to repentance, Christians, then yes, you're right. They do win. Absolutely. And sometimes the army that wins is the army that's willing to take the field. But always, the army that is not willing to even take to the field loses. Period. No ifs, ands, or buts. That is always the way that it works. It works in every area of life. If we are so sedated and so intimidated that we're not even willing to take the field, call it. They've got it. And it will take a miracle to save us from their grasp. But on that note, let's talk about a few items in the news and let's ask the question, what could be done about these things? What should be done about these things? Let's make some value judgments based on current events, what is actually going on in the world. Tim Meads over at the Daily Wire reports, Hunter's attorney's defense of the so-called laptop is so ludicrous, it's laughable. Subtitle, where did this team of attorneys come from? The law offices of Dewey, Cheatham, and Howe? Do you ever get the sense we live in a clown world run by imbeciles? Yes, we do. The latest example of the sheer stupidity of our so-called elites can be found in the latest updates regarding Hunter Biden's infamous laptop from hell. On Wednesday, Biden the Younger's legal team sent a letter to the United States Department of Justice and the Delaware Attorney General requesting an investigation into, quote, individuals for whom there is considerable reason to believe violated various federal laws in accessing, copying, manipulating, and or disseminating Mr. Biden's personal computer data, end quote. The letters were taken by many as a sign that Hunter was finally confirming that Hunter's laptop left at John Paul Mac Isaac's repair shop was actually his. Readers will remember that 51 former intelligence officials claimed that the New York Post's original 2020 report on the computer was Russian disinformation. In turn, Twitter censored the story, and the rest is history. Hunter has never denied or confirmed that it's his laptop, so the legal request sent this week appeared to be a stunning admission. Then his attorneys released a statement so ludicrous, it is laughable. Biden's counsel claimed that the request for a criminal investigation does not in any way confirm that the laptop is actually his. Quote, these letters do not confirm Mac Isaac's or others' versions of a so-called laptop, end quote. Hunter's attorney, Ab Lowell, told Fox News, quote, they address their conduct of seeking, manipulating, and disseminating what they allege to be Mr. Biden's personal data wherever they claim to have gotten it, end quote. So, full stop, I'll post a link to the rest of this story in the description for this podcast episode, so you can go check it out, you can read the full thing yourself. But I will say this. One, this is wicked. It's not just stupid, right? The problem is not stupidity, because the solution is not education. The problem is evil. The problem is wickedness. The problem is corruption. The problem is that these people do not fear God, and they are banking on us fearing them more than we fear God. The problem is not stupidity. It's not that Hunter is stupid. It's not that his lawyers are stupid. It's not that we are stupid. We know exactly what this is. He's lying. Plain and simple, he is lying. His lawyers are lying. He is lying. And it's absurd. And do you know what? This is a kind of defiance, not just against us, but it's a defiance of the laws of God, that the president of the United States' son would commit all of the crimes that are documented. He would do all of the wicked, evil things against God's law, but yes, also even against the laws of men. Even corrupt, godless men have said that the things that he is documented as having done on that laptop, on his laptop, which he just confirmed is his laptop, that these are wrong. They're against the law. They're immoral. They're unethical. They're corrupt. And nothing has been done about it. Not really. And do you know what? This doublespeak, it is not actually meant to persuade. It's meant to confuse, and it's meant to threaten. While we're confused, we will realize, many of us, that we're too afraid to say, hey, wait a second, that doesn't make sense, that's wrong. And even if we say, hey, you know what, that doesn't make sense, that's wrong, if we're not willing to do anything about it, well then, we might as well not say anything about it. Because what if the same guy who is this corrupt and this wicked and this evil and this dishonest is willing to do something about us saying anything about it? That's the way that the line of reasoning goes, and that's how countries become more and more and more corrupt until they implode or are finished off by some other country with a more functional set of morals. I'm not saying a godly country. This is why it is possible in the Old Testament for other nations that are not God's people to be given a victory over God's people in the Old Testament, because it's not a question of you only win if you are morally perfect. If you're more virtuous, if you're more functional, all other things being equal, you're going to win, because right and wrong come into play on the battlefield. They come into play on the preparations for battle and for making war. They come into play in being able to consolidate gains after a war has been won. Right and wrong are terribly relevant also to maintaining a country. And this cannot be tolerated. The consequences for this are huge if Hunter is given a pass because his daddy is the president of the United States of America. This implicates the president of the United States as well. If the laptop is now admitted by Hunter's lawyers, it implicates that the president was taking bribes and kickbacks from foreign countries like China, like Russia, like Ukraine. He was taking bribes from foreign countries who we might be at war with very shortly. We're sending tanks to the Ukraine to fight against Russia. Almost half, just under half of the tanks that are being sent by NATO to Ukraine are American tanks. And Russia's response to that is, boy, it really looks like we're already at war. And if that's the case, if we are actually just playing a semantics game and we're as dishonest about the state of war that exists or doesn't exist between us and Russia right now as our lawyers and law enforcement and lawmakers and judges in this country who might look the other way on the Hunter Biden laptop story. No, correction, continue, who might continue to look the other way on the overwhelming evidence of wrongdoing and corruption in our government. If we are as dishonest, here's the thing. You might be able to fool some of the people some of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time, particularly when the people you are claiming to be fooling are in other countries with their own governments, particularly when those governments might be able to build something of a coalition or dismantle your coalition by pointing out the hypocrisy and the immorality of your own government and your own approach, the dishonesty, the rank dishonesty. China flying a spy balloon over Billings, Montana. And again, might I just repeat, I'm from Montana. I've been to Billings, Montana many, many times before we moved to Colorado and started being able to avail ourselves of Costco and Sam's Club and the doctor's office and Walmart, just 15 minutes drive from our house. When we lived in Sydney, Montana, we had to drive over 4 hours one way each way, and we would make round trips sometimes once a month to Billings because that's where Costco and Sam's Club and all the rest were. But Billings, Montana, why would a Chinese spy satellite be flying over Billings, Montana? Unless the Chinese wonder if maybe just possibly they should come down into the U.S. through Canada. Yeah. There's an idea. Is it possible? Is it even remotely possible that Canada would let them do that? Maybe ask it a different way. Is it possible that Canada would be able to stop them? Also, too, Justin Trudeau allowing the Chinese military to do joint winter exercises in Canada, just over the border from the United States. The Canadian military raising an absolute stink about it. Like, are you kidding? Like, what? What are you thinking? Like, this is the dumbest idea ever. And you've had some doozies. Well, nevertheless, if you have communist sympathizers in the government of Canada, and you definitely do, if you have communist sympathizers in the government of the United States of America, and we definitely do, if you have Hunter Biden and Joe Biden having taken money from communists, and then all of a sudden we've got a Chinese spy balloon still, to my knowledge, flying over the United States of America, and we're not shooting it down, put this in the category of things that make you go, The point is not to persuade us here. The point is to confuse and intimidate us and to get us to despair and to get us to suppose that there is no more justice. Justice is a thing of the past and it's not coming back. If we accept that, then woe to us. You know, I was just reading, trying to catch up on my Bible reading for the year because I set a goal for myself to read through a chapter of the Bible every day this year. And I have fallen off a few times, but I am trying to get back on again. And when I do get back on, I make up for lost time. If I can, if it's been 5 days since I read a chapter, well, then I'm going to read 5 chapters so that I get caught back up again. And I want to stop needing to catch up and I want to start actually doing this every day. But the next best thing to being consistent is trying to make it right when you get a chance. So I read, or should I say, listened to 14 chapters of Genesis this morning before I started recording here. And that is to say, I was 2 weeks behind, but a little bit more because actually I'm not all the way caught up yet. I still need to do February 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. Today's the 3rd. Also, might I just add, as a aside, if you are looking for a good audio Bible, check out Dwell, D-W-E-L-L. I'll put a link in the description for this episode. Dwell is fantastic. There's a lot you can do as far as picking playlists, really, of verses. If you want to listen through those verses, to meditate on those verses on a particular subject, you can pick from a number of different narration voices. You can have music playing in the background. You can control the audio levels to where it's a lot quieter. It could be, you know, very light guitar or piano or what have you to be playing while these verses are being read. It's really, really good stuff. You can speed it up, slow it down. It's really, really a great app. It'll also keep track of how much time you have listened on a daily basis, things like that. Some nerds like me enjoy those kinds of facts. It can be motivating to see, hey, you know what? I'm listening to my Bible more and more. Definitely check out the Dwell app. But back to my point with regards to listening to Genesis 16 through 31. I think that makes 14, maybe 15. Anyway, that selection of Genesis is really good stuff that we need to get more acquainted with for a number of reasons. One being, Abraham is old when God tells him that there's going to be a child born to Abram and Sarai. Both of them are very old. And there's a kind of delighted incredulity. Not unbelief in the sense of, I reject that, but like, I don't know what to say. How can this be? Very similar to Mary's response when she's told in the gospel accounts that she's going to be pregnant and give birth to a son who will be the Messiah. How can this be? Right? It's an honest question, right? I'm not saying it can't. I'm just saying I don't understand. You're going to have to unpack that for me. In Abraham's case, it's, we are very old. We are very old. That's not typically something that is compatible with our advanced age. And also, if we weren't able to have children when we were younger, like there's a fertility issue in the mix here, then why would us getting older help that? I don't understand. Remarkable, the promise that God makes at the timing that he does. He is not doing that by accident. He's doing that to demonstrate his power. And we ought not to think in a godless way as though either everything depends on us or else it doesn't matter what we do or don't do. Both of those are erroneous and unbiblical. But nevertheless, the whole business with Abram and Sarai traveling through foreign kingdoms and Abram telling his wife, you're very beautiful, even at a very old age, she's very beautiful, and tell people that you are my sister because they're going to see that you are beautiful. They're going to kill me and take you, and just let's avoid that, right? Can we just skip that? We don't want any trouble. Tell people that you're my sister. Well, it happens a couple of times, and it doesn't just happen to Abram. It happens to his son as well, Isaac, that their wives get taken by the kings of pagan nations, taken because they're going to be added to the harem. And because the perception is that Abram or Isaac are the brother of these beautiful women who are being taken by the kings, they are given very generous gifts to try and curry favor so that there's a blessing, right? Please bless our interest in your sister because we would like to take her to be one of our wives. And also we want to have a friendly relationship with you. We want to have a kind of alliance with you. And again, God intervenes, even though Abraham and Isaac are, shall we say, not setting the best of examples here in how to protect your wife, how to guard your wife. God intervenes. God says, you are a dead man. You have taken someone else's wife. He's a prophet. You give her back. Don't touch her. And he will pray for you. And I will listen to his prayer and I will forgive you for this. And in all the cases, the king is like, why didn't you tell me that she was your wife? Do you realize how much trouble you've caused? Do you realize what you've done to me? You set me up. Another extraordinary thing is that when Isaac is old himself and his eyes have failed him, nevertheless, Esau is daddy's favorite. Jacob is mama's favorite. Very interesting. Both mom and dad there have picked their favorites. And Esau, even though he's married women that his parents do not approve of, multiple women, yes. And that's a feature. That's a feature that is all over the Old Testament. And when I say this, please understand how I mean it. Who are we to judge? I think given the depravity of our day, serial monogamy, infidelity, fornication, homosexuality, transgenderism, you know what? If we had their problems, we might have less problems than we have right now. I'll put it that way. But you have Isaac and you have Rebecca, each with their favored son. And who is it that actually gets the blessing? Interestingly, not the one that Isaac would have chosen and was planning to choose. Isaac was planning to bless Esau, even though Esau had married some very troublesome women, and it displeased his parents a lot. Also, too, see the way that he responds. I mean, for one, he initiates the surrendering of his birthright because he's hungry, which is to say, he holds his birthright in very little esteem, apparently, if he would sell it for a bowl of soup. But then he ends up regretting it, right? He ends up regretting it after the fact and then pretending like he's actually the victim of Jacob's schemings. But then it's Rebecca who says, hey, I've got an idea. I've got a plan. I want you to pretend to be your brother and take your father some food and he will give you the blessing. And that's very curious. Is this dysfunctional? Yep. Yep, it is. Is this scheming? Yes, indeed. Does it work anyways? Uh-huh. And it's an odd business that this is the origin story for the people of Israel. This is important for us to think about because it speaks to the character of God, that God uses who he uses in the way that he uses them, in the context that he uses them, despite imperfections, and sometimes even using those imperfections to accomplish his purposes. What you meant for evil, God used for good, as Joseph, Jacob's son, ends up telling his brothers at a certain point. But I think here too of Lot. Lot in Sodom. There's another case study. And not just because those buggers in Sodom and Gomorrah end up incurring God's wrath. The cup of God's wrath is filled up at a certain point and then needs to be poured out. No. It's interesting. It's very, very interesting what is said about Lot, that he is righteous. And you have God and Abraham negotiating, haggling, as it were, over the destruction of a city because even one righteous man might live there. Far be it from you, Abraham says, far be it from you to punish the righteous with the wicked. And it doesn't say that and then leave open to us that, well, Lot, you know, Lot's not really righteous. There is no one who is righteous. No, the biblical text says at many points that this or that man was righteous or blameless in his generation. That doesn't mean perfect, but it, means that he has right standing with God. And that's up to God to decide. Take it up with God if you object. It's up to God to decide who has right standing before him. So if God says, if his word, which is God breathed and profitable, says that Lot had a righteous soul, his righteous soul was vexed daily in Sodom because of the wickedness of that city, well, then Lot had a righteous soul. And given the context of the negotiation between Abram and God over if there's even one righteous man in Sodom, and then God sending angels to extract, like special forces going in to do an extraction in a hostage situation, God gets Lot and his daughters out. Not that his daughters are so righteous, but it is very, very important that we study what Genesis says in detail and we ponder the potential implications for our understanding of the character of God in particular, because God has not changed. His character has not changed. He is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Consider the response of Lot to these angels being under threat from the men of Sodom. Also, consider that back and forth there, is it awful that Lot offers his daughters to the men of Sodom? Hey, please don't abuse these men. They're my guests. Here, have my daughters. You can do whatever you want with them. Based on their conduct later on, it might not be that they actually are chaste, shall we say. It is of note that the men say that we're not interested in that. Moreover, it's interesting that they get angry. They are angry with Lot. Why? Because Lot has just told them, no, don't do this evil thing. Whoa, trigger warning. Did you just say that what we want to do is evil? Did you just tell us no? What did you say to me? What did you tell us? How dare you? Who appointed you judge? You come in here. You're not from around here. We let you live in our city, and you dare to tell us no? Who do you think you are? We're going to do worse things to you than we would have to your guests. And they're ready to basically knock down his door and violate and torture Lot, the men of Sodom are, because he told them no. Because he said, even just a redirect. And here's the problem with compromise, ladies and gentlemen, with regards to politics. Here's the problem with compromise. The men of Sodom come to your front door and they say, send out the men who are guests there, these visitors we know are staying with you. Send them out so that we can have sex with them. And this is not, hey, whatever you guys consent to as adults. No. This is, they have become so reprobate, so corrupt, so wicked. This is why God's destroying their city. They don't care about consent. And they're certainly not caring about consent with regards to Lot. It's Lot's house. They don't respect that it's Lot's house. They're threatening Lot all because he said no on his property. They don't respect his property rights. They don't respect his person. They don't respect his morals. Consent gets boring for the truly corrupt and the wicked. And it is only supernatural intervention that blinds the men of Sodom, buying time for the angels to get Lot and his wife and his daughters out. Although his wife looks back. His wife looks back and wants to get one last look at the city to remember it fondly. And the reason why she's turned into a pillar of salt is because Sodom would be going with her otherwise. That's what it means that she's looking back, is she wants to take the city of Sodom with her where she goes. God is not impressed, shall we say. The problem politically in Sodom is that the Sodomites have no fear of God. They are unjust. They are corrupt. They are selfish. They are greedy. They are self-indulgent. They are lovers of pleasure, not lovers of God. Their God is their belly. They're corrupt. They're wicked men. They're evil, thoroughly, not just on the issue of homosexuality, thoroughly. Homosexuality is just the latest fad. So what does God do? He rains down fire on Sodom and the cities of the plain, not just Sodom, because usually with a metro area like that, it's not just that city. It's also the surrounding towns, suburbs, etc. They all trade and do business at the permission of, blessing of that central city. God destroys it. We should do some careful thinking about what we compromise about and how future generations, provided the world stands, will think of us. Think of that uncomfortable, nauseous feeling you feel about Lot being willing to compromise with the men of the city. And by the way, it's not about sex. It's about power. Just a little observation there. If it were about sex, then the men of the city of Sodom would have said, okay, great. Yeah, send your daughters out. That's fine. No, it's about power. It's about dominance. And God is not going to be threatened or bullied. The cup of wrath is filled, and then it's poured out, and he destroys the city. But he gets Lot out. And you think to yourself, you know, back to Abram and Lot having to go separate ways because their servants, their flocks are so numerous that there's bickering back and forth between the servants of Abram and the servants of Lot over how to feed and water these animals. Abram has the option to take first dibs, first pick of where he's going to go, and then Lot's going to go the other direction. Abram, I think, in a gracious way and also trusting God, gives Lot the first pick. And maybe he had a notion, maybe he understood how Lot was and what he might pick, and Abram didn't want that anyway, so it's a win-win-win. I'll let you pick, and I know exactly what you're going to pick, so it's just fine to me. So Lot goes one way, Abram goes the other way. And maybe Lot picked the better economic opportunity in the short term, but in the long run, what did it cost? What does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? It might have been profitable and lucrative in the short term. In the long run, it cost him everything. He only got out with his own life and his daughters, and even his daughters, though, they get children for themselves by their father after getting him drunk. That is messed up. What? How is this in the Bible? What? What in the world? It's complicated, shall we say. Moving on. Mr. Retrops over at Not the Bee writes, as of yesterday, starting this year, students in the State of New York University system must take DEI and social justice courses as part of their generals. And oh, by the way, this is communism. Just call it what it is. This is communism. They are increasingly brazen and willing to just force you to be tolerant, to be inclusive, to be diverse, to be equitable, to be a communist. They're increasingly willing in New York State, in California State, on the coasts, they are increasingly willing to just force you to be a communist. Moving on. North Dakota. Let's talk about the middle of the country, right next door to Montana, where I'm originally from. Actually, most of the 7 years that I worked in the Bakken, as they call it, or the Williston Basin formation, primarily, I was working in western North Dakota, a little bit in eastern Montana, but mostly in western North Dakota, Williston, Watford City, Dickinson area. North Dakota mayor moves to block Chinese-owned corn mill after warning from Air Force. Reporting by Leif LeMahieu over at the Daily Wire. A North Dakota mayor has moved to block approval of a Chinese-owned corn mill in his town after the Air Force warned that it could potentially be a national security threat. Grand Forks Mayor Brandon Bochensky, a Republican and former NHL player, said that with the city council's approval, he would block the opening of the mill, operated by Fufang USA, an American subsidiary of a Chinese company. The federal government, this is a quote, the federal government has requested the city's help in stopping the project as geopolitical tensions have greatly increased since the initial announcement of the project, Bochensky said in a statement. Quote, the only remedies the city has to meet this directive is to refuse to connect industrial infrastructure and deny building permits. As mayor of the city of Grand Forks, I am requesting these remedies be undertaken and the project be stopped pending city council approval, end quote. Now, this is very, very curious on a number of levels. One, why is the federal government asking for the city's help in stopping the project? That's curious. Republican senators from North Dakota, John Hoeven and Kevin Kramer, received a letter from the Air Force detailing the Air Force's concern about the project. This proposed mill would be 12 miles from Grand Forks Air Force Base. Now, why is the Air Force having to ask for help from Republican senators, much less the mayor of Grand Forks? Why? Also, too, we've got North Dakota Republican Governor Doug Burgum, who says he supports the move to pull approval for the mill. Here's a quote from Doug Burgum. As we said previously, our top priority is the security of our citizens and our nation, he said in a statement. Given these concerns, we support the decision by the city of Grand Forks to initiate steps to stop the project with Fufeng Group, and we'll support the city in finding another partner for a corn milling operation, end quote. Again, it's a very curious thing that the president of the United States of America doesn't seem to be engaged on this. Why is it all Republicans having to tell the Chinese Communist Party no? Things that make you go, Balloon spotted over Billings being investigated as Chinese spy satellite. The silvery balloon spotted over Billings that shut down air traffic and brought fighter jets, AWACS, and air tankers to the area on Wednesday afternoon is suspected to be of Chinese origin, according to a source who spoke to NBC News. Reporting by Billings Gazette, quotes Pentagon spokesperson Brigadier General Pat Ryder talking with NBC News. The United States government has detected and is tracking a high-altitude surveillance balloon that is over the continental United States right now. We continue to track and monitor it closely. Once the balloon was detected, the U.S. government acted immediately to protect against the collection of sensitive information. Yeah, but how? What are they trying to collect? And again, how? Are they trying to gobble up data that's in the airwaves with this spy satellite? Like short-range communications? Is this the preliminary move ahead of an invasion? What's getting gobbled up? What's being intercepted, potentially? And oh, by the way, why didn't you shoot it down? Why hasn't the U.S. government shot it down just yet? Supposedly, the reason is a concern about falling debris. Harriet Alexander for DailyMail.com. U.S. is monitoring Chinese spy balloon that has been floating over Montana for the past several days. Biden wanted to shoot it down. Of course, sure he did. Biden wanted to shoot it down with F-22s, but Pentagon advised him not to because of falling debris. Heaven help us if we ever actually get in a shooting war with China, because I guess we're going to hold our fire so that we don't have falling debris. Just, you know what? Let's do an environmental impact study on whether we should just surrender to the Chinese Communist Party. That actually makes so much sense. I could actually see that being a real statement, a real explanation and justification for our leaders surrendering to China. Moving on. Candace Hathaway over at theblaze.com writes, Martha Stewart sharpens sword in bizarre Pfizer booster commercial. Quote, you know that unwelcome guest everyone wishes would just leave already? Now, supposedly, she's sharpening the samurai sword and then slicing the head off of a pineapple because that's what the COVID booster does to COVID. But I don't know. It's super weird. It's super weird that it's just kind of left open to the imagination, open to interpretation, particularly when the Pfizer exec recently did the interview with Project Veritas. He didn't know at the time that he was being interviewed, but when he says, yes, yeah, Pfizer is doing research and development on new vaccines against new mutated strains of COVID via, and I quote, directed evolution, even as he smiles at it being called a gain of function. No, it's not. I mean, it's not technically gain of function. Yes, it is. You're a liar. You are a liar. You know exactly what we're talking about. Don't play those semantics games with us. You are engineering new strains of COVID so that you can develop the vaccines. If you're willing to do that, and also the corporate media and big tech is going to look the other way or silence and shut up anybody who wants to report on it, share it, view it. What if you were willing to develop those strains and also unleash them? Create the problem with the prepackaged solution that is ready already before you unleash the problem. Create the problem so that then you can sell the solution. Boy, that is quite the business model, if that's at all even possibly what you're doing. And you know what? I'm not saying that's what they did do, but I am saying, one, it justifies suspicions that COVID originally was engineered in a lab and released on purpose for geopolitical reasons and purposes by the left here in this country and the communists in China. It justifies suspicions because it can be done, and it is being done, in the words of the director of R&D at Pfizer himself. Interesting, huh? Very interesting. Moving on, let's talk about our big topic, our main attraction here. Technopoly, The Surrender of Culture to Technology by Neil Postman. Publisher's summary over at audible.com. Release date 9/11/2012. In this witty, often terrifying work of cultural criticism, Postman chronicles our transformation into a technopoly, a society that no longer merely uses technology as a support system, but instead is shaped by it. According to Postman, technology is rapidly gaining sovereignty over social institutions and national life to become self-justifying, self-perpetuating, and omnipresent. He warns that this will have radical consequences for the meanings of politics, art, religion, family, education, privacy, intelligence, and truth as they are redefined to fit the requirements of the technological thought world. Copyright 1992. Allow me to just start off my commentary on this book by saying you should read it. You should read this book, and you should also read another book by Neil Postman, Amusing Ourselves to Death. If you would read those two books, you would see our current situation here in the United States of America in the year 2023 in a new light. It's not as though all of your answers will come from those two books. All of your questions will be answered. It's not that. I don't want to oversell it. But Neil Postman is very bright, very insightful, a good communicator, a good commentator, and he is drawing out some very important features that we need to pay more attention to. For one, on this whole question of technopoly, not just do we have a lot of technology in the United States of America, we generate a lot of invention, but have we considered that some of how our technology is designed and advertised and sold and supported makes our technology not just a tool, not just a means of having fun, learning, amusing ourselves, entertaining ourselves, transporting ourselves, expanding our capabilities. Also, our technology can be used and is used to harness us. And when I say harness us, what I really mean, and please listen closely, this technology can be used to control us. And there's a kind of shackles that if we are not wise, if we are not intentional, if we are not discerning, if we are not careful, if we do not continually go back to God's word to be transformed by the renewing of our minds in Christ Jesus, we become slaves to this technology. But more than that, we become slaves to those who sell us this technology. This is not a minor point. This is not an exaggeration. This is not me trying to scare you. But we ought to be sober-minded about, for instance, the Stanford Persuasive Technology Lab in Palo Alto, California. We ought to be very mindful of the addictive quality to our smartphones, our computers, our TVs, our video games, our movies sometimes, but increasingly TV shows on streaming networks. When people binge watch a TV show and they say, I just can't help it. I just want to watch the next one and the next one and the next one. And that might be their entire day or weekend. That could be speaking to an addictive quality. But what do we mean by these things being addictive? When someone can't put down their smartphone and they just keep compulsively scrolling Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, Pinterest, they just keep on compulsively reaching for their phone, checking their phone, almost as though they can't help it. Almost as though they're addicted, and that's increasingly the language that we use. What would we say if it turned out that the Persuasive Technologies Lab in Palo Alto, California, is set up to make these things addictive? But more than that, what would we say if the big tech companies, which have been founded and led by and so successful based on the products of the Stanford Persuasive Technologies Laboratory in Palo Alto, California, what would we say if those technologies, those companies, those brands, those applications, those websites, those games, those movies, those TV shows were designed with close consultation to make them addictive? Close consultation with psychologists who understand how the brain creates these incentive loops. When dopamine is released because we push the lever and a food pellet comes out. Oh, I'm sorry. We're talking humans, not rats. When the human being hears the ding of the bell, like Pavlov's dogs salivating, it doesn't matter whether there's actually a value being added when they look at their phone, because they're going to do it anyways, because they're being trained. These things are programmed so that we can be programmed. These things are designed so that we can be redesigned as a society, as individuals, as men and women and children, so that we can be social engineered. Period. Full stop. Not accidentally. Totally on purpose by the people who are the best at it. They say things like, well, if we don't do it, somebody else will. And every evil that has ever been done by man is easily justified when you say, well, if we don't do it, somebody else will. That doesn't make it right. If it's evil, then it would be evil if somebody else were to do it. It doesn't become less evil just because you do it first and do it better and do it harder and do it at a higher level or a higher rate or more skillfully. So technopoly really has to do with our relationship with technology as individuals, as families, as communities, as citizens, should we say? Citizens of the United States in particular. You know, when it's the corporate media and we catch the corporate media in a lie or a half-truth, or we catch the corporate media not covering some huge story that might reflect badly on a company like Pfizer, a total news blackout. Or when we find that big tech is suppressing stories like the Hunter Biden laptop story and even taking offline journalistic institutions, well-founded, long-established news organizations, because they would cover and then share to Twitter the news items. When we find that we've been lied to either by half-truths or total fabrications or with the denial of objectively verifiable true statements and claims and stories, we begin to suspect that we are being played. And we begin to suspect that there might be something else going on besides just these being individual companies separate with their own interests. Let's say, for instance, making honest mistakes. Well, when the honest mistakes all happen to be synchronized and on a consistent pattern of error, well, then you have to go back and you have to consider, why is that? Now, the reasons might be because of what we all collectively believe. It could be an innocent mistake, so to speak, kind of, sort of, because we don't believe as we ought to. Sure, but let's drill down a little bit deeper. There's different levels to not believing as we ought to. There's one level where it's just ignorance, like nobody told me. I never learned these things in school. You'll hear some people say, why didn't they teach me this in history when I went to a public school in high school or in college? Why didn't they teach me this? Right? You just didn't know, right? You didn't know. That's one kind of not believing as we should, perhaps. There's another kind where somebody has presented it, but we're not sure if it's reputable. And so we're like, I don't know. I'm not sure. I'll think about it, okay? But I'm not ready to commit yet, right? That's one kind of not believing as we ought to. Call it double-mindedness, where at the one hand, we're not ready to totally reject what it is that's being said. On the other hand, we're not ready to just totally accept it either. But there's a third kind of not believing as we ought to. There's a third form in which you might say it's the willful rejection of right belief. It is the stubborn refusal to believe and also an outright hostility to belief. That's a third kind of not believing as we ought to. First, you have those who don't know, and how will they know unless someone tells them? Second, you have, Lord, I believe, help me with my unbelief, perhaps. Third, you have, but Pharaoh hardened his heart. Or, as it says, God hardened Pharaoh's heart. Now, here's a new way to think about the whole story of Pharaoh and Moses and Aaron and the children of Israel in 400 years of bondage to the Egyptians. Imagine, if you will, that all of our ancestors, all of the people who've lived hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago, they weren't dumb people. They weren't stupid people. There were stupid people. There have always been stupid people. But they weren't, as a rule, stupid people. We have some very smart people alive today. Hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago, they also had some very smart people. Some people who must have been smart enough to have figured things out that we don't know, because some of the things that we find in the archaeological record, old ruins and monuments and monoliths and things like that, we can't explain how they did it. We don't know. Our best engineers don't know how they did it. But more than that, there were some very smart, sophisticated, clever, and accomplished, capable people. And if they were going to be anywhere, they were going to be in places like the Babylonian Empire, the Egyptian Empire, when those two were at their peak, and when those two were the peak of human civilization in their day, in their heydays. If there were clever people, they were going to be at the very center. And by clever, I don't necessarily mean that they were all the most brilliant, but shrewd, right? Clever, smart, in a street smart sort of a way, also in a political savvy sort of a way. And so what is it that we find when we have the children of Israel in 400 years of hard bondage as a solution to the problem of not just overpopulation in a general sense, but overpopulation of the children of Israel in particular? We find that Pharaoh comes up with a very discreet, very precise target, the Hebrew baby boys. And he's not going to go after them himself directly. No, no, that's too messy. He's not going to send soldiers in to just stand guard over every Hebrew woman who might potentially give birth. That's going to lead to fighting. The people of Israel might rise up, and they might, I mean, if the men have any protective instincts over their wives and their children, they're probably going to band together, and you're going to have an internal conflict. And you don't want that, right? You don't want that. That's not smart, right? That's not clever. So what is it that Pharaoh does? He calls the midwives in, and he says, I want you to kill every Hebrew baby boy born alive. And why is that? Because if you can control who all is allowed to breed, as it were, this is selective breeding. If you can control who all is allowed to breed, then you will control the demographics. You will change the dynamics even before all of those baby boys and the Egyptian baby boys have come of age. Even before that, you will have changed the dynamic, because I can tell you this as a father of seven sons and one daughter. The birth of a son, it has a psychological effect on me, even as just one father of seven sons. And my seven sons are not all of fighting age, shall we say. And several are getting to that age. They're close. But they're not old enough to enlist in the military and go off and, you know, defend Ukraine or stop the Chinese from taking over Taiwan or coming down through Canada or whatever, right? They're not quite there yet, but they're close. But even so, with the birth of each one of my seven sons, I've had enough samples to be able to tell you it changes my thinking as a father. So you've got Pharaoh realizing he can have a dampening effect on the Hebrews in Egypt to eliminate their baby boys. Only girls. You will only be raising daughters, you Hebrews, and you will be thinking to yourself, you want to find good sons for your daughters when they come of age. You're going to have to get along with and impress, in some sense, the Egyptian neighbors of yours if you want your daughters to marry as well as they can as Hebrew girls. Right? And it, just like that, right? Just like that, you can change the dynamic. You can social engineer your country. And yet what happens? Those Hebrew midwives, they fear God and they disobey and they lie. So they're kind of like, if you will, to use a pop culture reference, they're kind of like the guy who engineers the Death Star and sets it up for failure on the front end. These Hebrew midwives kind of, you know, pretend like they're going along with it, but they're not really. And the Hebrew baby boys who are born include, but are not limited to, Moses and Aaron. And yet there still is. There's kind of an escalation because that didn't work. And so now Pharaoh's going to get a little bit more ratcheting it up. And the point is, those same ways of thinking, those same attitudes that we read about in Genesis are still in the human heart and the human mind right now. And only by the grace of God are they rooted out, restrained, held in check, countered only by the grace of God and the power and the goodness of God do those worst tendencies in man not consume us and destroy us. And so now we come back to the question of technopoly. And this is probably the biggest reason why I don't give him 5 stars. I give him 4 stars, which is good, right? It's a good book. Technopoly is a good book. I don't give it 5. I'll give it 4 because he throws in some pot shots at the creationists, right? But all the while, even though he kind of mocks them for being anti-science, sort of, you know, he doesn't dwell on it so much, just passing pot shots like, oh, I'm not saying I'm with those guys. He admits, too, at the same time, that our evolutionary worldview has consequences for the development of technology, for the application of technology, for the use of tech by the people who develop and sell the tech. In some sense, the technology that we enjoy so much, we make so much use of, we're so enamored by the shiny new object. Every time a new model comes out, we're just, look, it's got this additional feature. Yeah, you know what? What if they had all of those features in the original one and they've just been teasing them to you with each latest model of your iPhone? How about that? You get a different feeling there, don't you? Oh, also, do you get a different feeling when you find out that Apple was intentionally throttling their older iPhones with software updates so that you would want to buy the newest version, just to nudge you in the direction of buying the latest model, even if your current one was fine? Even if you had taken very good care of it, you didn't drop it in the toilet, you didn't sit on it just wrong and crack the screen, like, you've kept it in good shape. But all of a sudden, it's getting really slow. Guess it's time to buy a new one. Technopoly should inform not just our habits as buyers, consumers. It should also make us very wary of how we use what we buy, how we feel about what we buy, how attached to emotionally we are what we buy. You know, the transhumanist business, it's very unsettling. And transhumanism, if you're not familiar, is this whole idea that we will be able to live forever as technology, biotech in particular, allows us to replace failed organs and even to enhance our natural abilities, implant a computer chip here to regulate this, change out an organ there with a synthetic version that will last a long time, kind of like a knee replacement, but for your internal organs as well, not just prosthetics, but augmentation, and in some people's minds, a blurring of the line between where you end and the machine begins, or where the machine ends and you begin. You become part man, part machine. You become a cyborg. What if it turned out that that's already been happening, as Neil Postman explains, even just in the kinds of parables that we tell to describe what's going on in our minds, or how we see the people around us, or how we see situations? So I'll give you an example. As somebody who's an automation technician myself, I will come home from work and I'll be trying to explain something, and I'll start reaching for language from work as a controls programmer, formerly a systems integrator, formerly an I&E technician, formerly an instrumentation technician, formerly an automation services regional supervisor for the Rocky Mountains, et cetera, et cetera. All of us, even if we're not particularly in tech like I am, all of us have started to describe ourselves and one another and situations in very mechanical ways. Gears, for instance, where the rubber meets the road. For instance, I've got too many tabs open on my browser in my mind, for instance. Increasingly, we start thinking of ourselves as hardware and software, and that is not by accident. It is actually the people who have been selling us these things who really, they think of us that way, and they want us to think of ourselves that way because it makes us all the more pliable. You see, if we are lights and clockwork, and if they are persuaded that they know best, then every time they talk about overpopulation, like Marx talks about overpopulation a lot, or excess population, every time we hear about or read about overconsumption, reducing our consumption, reducing our carbon footprint, you need to understand that the people who don't believe they're ever going to be accountable to God, or they don't fear God, or they don't listen to God, they don't obey God, they don't trust God, those people, apart from God, have no reason to stop short of applying the same kinds of solutions that other godless men or other pagans have applied to such problems since the beginning of recorded history. Period. Full stop. You know, think of it this way. The children of Israel, literally the sons and their families of Jacob, who was renamed Israel, after he wrestled with God, the children of Israel are brought into Egypt, and initially they are the most favored guests of Joseph, who under Pharaoh is the most valuable player in the Egyptian state. He's able to interpret Pharaoh's dream, predicting, forecasting 7 years of plenty, so economic boom, followed by 7 years of famine or economic bust. Over the years, Genesis says that the memory of Joseph faded away. And we see this even just in our own recent American history. A few decades go by, and it doesn't even take very many. And however good this or that president seemed to be in his day, he is ancient history and totally irrelevant. George Washington? Psh, who's that? Who cares? Here, watch this video on TikTok that I just found. Isn't this funny? And just like that, that's how it went for the children of Israel in Egypt. And as they're having more and more kids and they're settled and it's a very plentiful place to live, it's a very economically prosperous part of the world, the food is plentiful, not just during a famine that they've prepared for, but at all times. It's rich in culture and architecture and music and science. And economically, Egypt is very well off. By extension, they are very influential in the world. This is the place to be. But the Hebrews, the children of Israel, the descendants of Jacob, grow so numerous that Pharaoh and the Egyptian people start to feel nervous. They get nervous about being replaced by the children of Israel, by the Hebrews. And so what do? They contrive of a scheme to enslave first and then to start selectively breeding the Hebrews. And what I mean by selectively breeding is exactly like you would selectively breed cows, sheep, goats, horses, dogs, for certain desired traits. They want to, they aspire to, they resolve to selectively breed the Hebrews. The Hebrew women, great, wonderful. We'll marry them off to our Egyptian men, and they will give birth to Egyptian children who will be raised in an Egyptian way so that our culture, our way of life, our view of the world maintains dominance in the world. But we have to eliminate the boys. We have to eliminate the masculine quality to Hebrew culture, if you will. I think that's exactly what we're seeing in what Neil Postman is describing as technopoly. We have our own modern day pharaohs who are trying to use technology to decide who can and cannot influence the public discourse, the way that we think, the way that we learn, the way that we live. They're trying to control who actually will be active versus passive, a culture maker versus somebody who just receives culture. And as such, we need to understand that the debates about free speech, the debates about transgenderism even, really boil down to the powers that be, the pharaohs of our day, having decided that some people just shouldn't reproduce. They just shouldn't breed. And so they've introduced a lot of very pernicious, subversive, evil suggestions into the minds of children. Namely, those ideas which will lead to those boys becoming, for all intents and purposes, eunuchs. Now the girls, we want to go through beauty regimens so that they can be plucked at will, just like King Abimelech in Genesis, just like Pharaoh, seeing a beautiful woman. If she's unavailable, they make her available by removing whoever it is that she is currently paired with. But if she's unavailable already, and you don't have to do any of that unpleasant work, you just take her, right? You just take her and add her to your household, like it's a collection. And so also, this is why there's been little to no accountability with the whole Jeffrey Epstein business, because Jeffrey Epstein was a middleman, and the people who were his customers, they still run the show, humanly speaking. But again, let's go back to God's word, because biblically speaking, he who sits in heaven laughs. He holds them in derision. Like, that's cute. And you know what we should glean from the book of Daniel and the book of Genesis? It takes one unpleasant dream that God permitted you to have for sleep to leave you. And all of the wealth in the world, all of the power in the world cannot protect you from the God of the universe in your dreams. But the flip side is that same God, that same Lord of all creation, who the psalmist says the earth belongs to and the fullness thereof, the world and its inhabitants, that same God will work all things to the good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. So let's go back to the whole technopoly thing. Consider, if you will, the shortage of Christian faith, the shortage of the fear of God in the big tech companies that right now are a kind of internet. And I don't mean internet like we say it too fast and we don't realize what that means. I mean internet that we're all caught up in. Consider the shortage of the fear of God. And also think about ancient Rome, the Roman Empire. Pax Romana was brutally achieved and enforced without mercy. The Appian Way, those roads were phenomenal. Those roads are still around. Man, we build roads and we've forgotten something. Going back to the whole, they had smart people back then. They did, because it doesn't seem like we know how to build roads as well as the Romans did. But they had an extensive network of roads and aqueducts, advanced cities, and they also kept the peace and they maintained trade and the flow of ideas throughout the empire. And it is not for no reason, I believe, that God decided to send his only begotten son into the world when he did, and for the gospel message, the Evangelion, to go out when it did, with, yes, Roman roads being what the apostles walked on. Roman peace being what, by and large, facilitated their travel between countries and peoples to preach that the Messiah had indeed come to conquer sin and death and to save his people. However great our tech is right now, It can be, if we're not careful, something that we become slaves to. But if we are wise, we can use what we find ourselves surrounded by in the way of technology, modern tech. We can use it to obey God and to serve God and to accomplish God's purposes by His grace and by His good pleasure. And so we should, but we've got to think of it like that. Seek ye first the kingdom of heaven. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all these other things will be added unto you. I'll leave you with this. Consider Ecclesiastes 2:25-26 in the ESV. For apart from Him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases Him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, but to the sinner, He has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. As an aside, methinks sometimes that Solomon in Ecclesiastes was just a little bit struggling with depression. Just a little bit of an Eeyore there. But he pressed on, and kudos to him for that. Kudos to him for that. God bless him for having written as plain and honestly as he did. To the sinner He has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to one who pleases God. Don't stress about it. Don't worry about it. Pay attention. Be sober-minded. Be vigilant. But don't stress. Don't stress. Don't get anxious. Don't be afraid. God's got this. Go to His Word. He'll tell you what to do. But I got to run. That's all the time I've got for this episode. Check out Technopoly. You won't be sad you did. You might be disturbed, but read on. Go back to the Word and be encouraged, friend. As always, thank you for listening. Until next time, God bless.
You've been listening to The Garrett Ashley Mullet Show on Anchor FM. For more content like what you just heard, subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. Also, check out thegarrettashleymulletshow.com to subscribe to email alerts when new episodes are published. As always, you can reach me with any comments, questions, complaints, objections, or insights at garrettashleymullet@protonmail.com.